And welcome everyone to another episode of All Things Trek. I'm Oren.
I am Grace.
I am David. Wait, was that too much? Not enough? I don't know.
No, that, I think that was just right.
Just the right amount. It goes with your new avatar on TeamSpeak, which is a really great picture of you with your Klingon ridges showing proud.
I deactivated my disguise hologram for the convention, so it was nice to let everybody see the real me.
Yeah, wear it loud, wear it proud.
All right, so we don't have any emails today, but I do have one thing that I want to promote before we actually do the show itself, which is an article by our friend Jara Hodge, which is featured right now on TrekRadio.net, which is her. It's a review of the Star Trek Bachelor Party comic, which she pitches as a movie concept to Robert Orci, which and I think is, yeah, I can see it is a hilarious review. You should all read it. The comic apparently includes a Orion like striptease to bagpipe music, which is not
oh
what I.
Oh my lord!
Yeah, not exactly a natural combination, I would think. But I mean, who knows? I'd love to. I'll see that on screen. Why not?
It's always cool when Scotty works the pipes, and it was a DC comic.
Say works the pipes again.
He was working them pipes. It was back when you know the Star Trek comic licensing is. Gone pretty much to every company that does comics. This was from 1984 DC Comics, and it was written by Peter David, which is interesting. And it's just, yeah, it's on her, I believe she posted it on her own Trekkie Feminist blog, and then she gave us permission to repost it and, you know, support it on Trek Radio's website, so definitely check it out. It was interesting. She picked up the comic at Star Trek Las Vegas and then was showing everybody, like, oh my god, look at this. But it's, you know, it's weird. It was weird. It was cool.
Maybe I could get her to mail it to me when she's done. Because it's got, like, it's about a Klingon in Starfleet. And at first I was ready to all call canon violation. And then I was like, wait a minute, this is from 1984.
Wait. That's what you're going to call canon violation with this comic?
Of the entire comic, that is the thing that upset you?
Well, no, it's just the first
or
thing that I
interest.
Noticed. It's just the first thing. I was just like, wait a minute, Klingon and Starfleet? That just seemed very odd. And then I was like, oh, because it's from 1984. So they hadn't established Worf as the first Klingon in Starfleet yet.
And the thing is, because it's in 84, they're all wearing the Monster Maroon Wrath of Khan uniform, the red top with the flap that opened. And so, yeah, a Klingon in a Wrath of Khan uniform. And it has, because it's comics, they got A-Rex from the animated series, but there's like bird people, little beaver people, like all kinds of crazy weirdness.
But all things considered, we've established that Oren's first love is consistency.
You know, it does matter to me, but you know, fair enough. So on to our main topic for today. We are discussing good episodes about bad characters, which is to say that there are bad characters in Star Trek. This we know. But there are some episodes which are really good about these bad characters, despite the fact that they're bad characters. But, Grace, you wanted to discuss first what our criteria are for a bad character?
I did. I wanted us to be able to look at this objectively and not just through the lens of characters that annoy us.
All right, well, the episodes that I've picked out are primarily about characters that I think are generally recognized as being, like, the worst characters of their series, like either the very worst or at the very bottom. Like,
right.
I'm talking like Wesley Crusher, Deanna Troi, Neelix, and Ezri Dax. I don't think those are too controversial. Like, even if you like Ezri Dax, most people will generally admit that Ezri was probably the weakest main character of Deep Space Nine. And then the last one is T'Pol, who I don't know how Enterprise fans feel about T'Pol as a rule. Like, I'm not tapped into that thought process. But
well,
she is...
For me personally, there's obviously T'Pol has issues. We could go to, like, Harry Mudd and some of these others. But for me personally, my worst Star Trek character is, like, painful to say and to think. But for me, it's Chuckles. I was so happy when I heard about the concept. And then when I
Chuckles.
Saw what was on screen, I was like, oh... Sadly.
Chuckles Chakotay.
Well, ironically, Chakotay is in here too. And again, I don't think there's going to be a lot of Chakotay fans who are upset that I picked him as a bad character. And the reason I picked T'Pol isn't because T'Pol is especially bad among Enterprise characters, because Archer is worse. But this one, I picked it because there is an episode specifically that is really good about T'Pol, which I like specifically about T'Pol, which is not something I can say about the other Enterprise characters. Like, there are good episodes that have them in it, but that not that are specifically about them. And so that was why I picked T'Pol, not because I think she's the worst character on Enterprise, but just because the contrast was so sharp. So with that, Grace, was there anything more you wanted to say on that subject?
Nope, just that we are going to go through this topic trying to maintain an objective viewpoint.
Right, because objectivity, that's me. My first and middle name, objectivity. My last name is whatever I feel like, so you know. But, so the first
dangerously.
Episode...
Orin, dangerously objectively.
Is obvious. This is correct. Now, so the first episode that I have is The First Duty, which I did not plan that. That's just how it ended up. Which is, if you don't recall, the episode where they go back to the Academy because there's been an accident in Wesley's, like, flight training program. And he like, one of his squad mates is dead. And Wesley's okay, but, like, you know, there has been a death, and now there's going to be an investigation and such. So have you guys both remember this episode?
Oh, yeah.
Yep. The birth of Tom Paris, sort of, kind of, not really, but maybe kind
of. The birth of not quite Tom Paris.
Yeah, Mr. Locarno. Totally not Tom Paris, but totally Tom Paris. And it also set up the character of Cito Jaxa for the Lower Decks episode several seasons later. But
that's
for the
true.
Most part, this is an episode about Wesley. And Wesley is an obnoxious character, really. There's no getting around that. He is just kind of boring and annoying when he's not being boring, because he's the boy genius who saves the ship even when he has no right to. And, you know, everyone knows this about Wesley. I'm not exactly breaking new ground here.
But no, I think also, oh, sorry. One of the big problems with writing Wesley is also, we earlier had an episode where we talked about child characters and how much agency they get and how some people really just have trouble writing younger characters. Wesley is a really good example of someone wanting to do a character that is precocious, but not knowing how to sort of portray that positively without making them completely annoying.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And the fact that Wesley so often makes fools of the, you know, of the trained Starfleet officers, or it just doesn't feel right, you know?
Exactly, yeah.
Well, and I think part of that is goes to the writers. I think they handled it in a weird way, because I thought, we see right off the bat, the Traveler says he's like a Mozart, but with warp theory and all that, and then early on, I thought they jumped too close too soon to him being the genius. Like, it should have been a longer development process, so that way he wouldn't be, like, embarrassing the chief engineer. But they just said, oh, he's going to be a boy genius, and then automatically he's saving the ship and doing everything. I thought it would have been stretch it out, handle it more of a development towards that, and then I think it would have been less annoying.
Right, but that would have required long-term planning on their part.
Oh, yeah.
Especially since, you know, early TNG especially was so allergic to the concept of continuity, right? It was kind of like every episode, each character kind of had to just be what they were going to be. We didn't have time for them to slowly get there. Fortunately, they sort of moved beyond that in the later seasons, and they actually had character continuity. But this episode in particular is sort of a standout because it and the other episode is Final Mission are the two episodes where Wesley actually acts like a real person and not, you know, Gene Roddenberry's idealized idea of a wonder kid. But the reason I picked this one instead of Final Mission is that in Final Mission, he still saves the day with technobabble, which is, and granted, he does it in a much more interesting way than he does most of the time, but it's still Wesley saving the day with technobabble, which is just something that we've gotten annoyed by. But in this episode, in The First Duty, the conflict is very poignant. It's about Wesley feeling torn between his loyalty to his Starfleet principles and his loyalty to his squad mates, because if anyone hasn't seen the episode recently, the reason that his squad mate died was because they performed or tried to perform this very dangerous and against the rules maneuver that they messed up and got somebody killed.
The covert starburst or whatever it was, like a flight maneuver where you ignite the plasma and make a big show in the sky. Now, I saw a post, and this was totally unrelated to our episode, but it was kind of timely. There was somebody that posted on Facebook a photo where it showed, like, young Wesley in his, you know, little sweater, and it was saying, you know, young Wesley was about never lying, never being, you know, bad or anything. And then it shows this episode, and he's like, Wesley's totally lying. Like, what's up with that? And I kind of thought with that when the younger Wesley, when he was, like, you know, among the children, I think the episode they screen capped was when all the children were abducted and they were learning to, like, carve wood with light or whatever. And
right,
Wesley's
yeah.
like, we can't do that. We got to, you know, protest and go home. And when you're young and like that, you're really idealized and, like, you know, don't lie, don't do bad, you know. And then when this episode, it's because he really gets wrapped up in the team, and Locarno is, like, such a persuasive, charismatic leader that it's like he's wanting to fit in, he's wanting to belong. So that's why I think it was understandable that young Wesley is, like, you know, Mr. By the Book. And then in this episode, he is in the dilemma of, like, he wants to perform, he wants to give his, you know, all to this little squad, but then it becomes the dilemma of do I tell what happened and all that. It was a really cool episode.
Right. This is one of the few times where we see Wesley in the context of trying to work with his peer group and not, like, a bunch of adults that he's trying to impress or, you know, be precocious around. This is him just trying to be, like, around people, and I think it's kind of a matter of him wanting their respect, his peers, and not really being used to that dichotomy with the people around him also.
Well, because we normally ever see Wesley either with the adults, where he's like the young one and kind of is odd man out, or they flip
exactly.
him, or they flip him to where he's with little children, like toddlers and little 10-year-olds, like small children. And then he's, like, the tallest, the oldest, and then he still stands out as the, so this was a good episode for Wesley, like, and great exchanges between him and Picard about, you know, principles and duty and responsibility and in a way even, like, honor about your personal honor and integrity. One question, First Mission was also a good one, but one I thought of that I wanted to see your opinion on.
Yes,
and
yes.
I could see it kind of going either way. I've heard different people have opinions of it or whatever. But Journey's End, would you call that a good episode for Wesley? To me, I like it for a number of reasons or layers to that episode. And I would nominate that, maybe not say give it the win, but I would nominate it as a good episode for Wesley. But what do you think about Journey's End?
Which one is that again?
Sorry.
Can you refresh my memory?
So Journey's End, or do you want to do it, David?
No, go for it.
All right, so Journey's End is the episode where Wesley comes back in season 7, and at the same time, the Enterprise has been ordered to remove a group of Native American colonists from the planet that they're on because it's been given to the Cardassians.
Right, yeah.
It's kind of the forerunner of the Maquis. It's not actually about the Maquis, but it's sort of similar.
It might as well be, yeah.
Right, and so it's been a long time since I've watched that episode, and if I had known that I should have watched it, because I should have figured we would have brought this up, I would have watched it again. I remember not liking it, because I recall it just seemed so weird that Wesley was so, like, mad, because I hadn't seen him for a long time, and then he shows up on the ship, and he's just so grumpy. And now that I think about it, I could see it making sense, since at the end of the first duty, he's basically told that he has to stay back a year and, like, everyone will know what he did and, like, he's gonna have this stigma attached to him. So I can actually see in retrospect why he would have that kind of attitude. But we hadn't seen Wesley for so long that when he showed up again in season 7 and he was all, like, you know, really rude and being, like, super, you know, like angsty, or not really angsty, but just, you know, rude is the right term, towards his friends and the other characters. I was just like, what's up, Wesley? I don't get it. Because I'd not gotten to see him dealing with those problems.
Well, and I think the reason
Yeah, we kind of
why...
got a character jump, didn't we?
And I think it fit because, you know, for one, it was like, you know, what's up with Wesley? Why is this like that? But then as you watch the episode, it kind of shows that what he did, you know, had to go through, especially with the Academy situation. But then it got to a point where he's getting older and he's not happy with, like, his life path at that point. And it's just like, it, when you get to in the episode, he's like walking someone else's path or trying to live someone else's life that they want him to do, not what he wants to do. And so I liked it because it, in some ways, you know, especially when it's kind of like emo Wesley at the beginning, you're like, I don't like this. But as the episode develops, it shows that he's like going out on his own. He's like being independent, not just trying to like, when somebody says my parents wanted me to be a doctor, so I went and become a doctor, even though I wanted to be a musician or something. That's like
right.
He's not living the life somebody else wanted for him. He's going off on his own. And it was interesting because there's times where it's like, is he really he was telling the natives like, hey, they're trying to move you, like don't let them do this to you. So in a way, he's going against his Starfleet crew, and you're like, what's he doing? Why he's, you know, being bad towards the Starfleet, but in a way, from another perspective, he was actually kind of doing the right thing, or a more like a, in his perspective at least, like doing a justified good, like, you know, moral thing, like, hey, don't let them do this to you. And mm-hmm. then it also, as the episode goes along, we kind of see that they're touching on not religion, but kind of like half spirituality, but half like just exploring the mind. Because the traveler comes in and he's like, you know, hey, you could do more with your mind and time travel and all this stuff. I just thought it was a good episode that had a lot to it. Not just like, oh, there's a problem. Wesley knows the science, you know, science formula, and Wesley saves the day. It was just, so I don't know if I would make that the best Wesley episode, but I definitely enjoyed it for his character growth. And at that point, and he becomes a traveler. It's also go ahead.
It's also interesting because that's the one where we kind of get to see Wesley as a character defy the dusting off an old chestnut here, the Roddenberry's vision of Starfleet is always right kind of thing. That's when we get to see Wesley be like, no, we are not right here, isn't it?
Yeah, because so there's a definite Wesley, you know, big story arc with this, and he's all over it. But then there's the other half of it that does relate to Wesley, and he's like saying, this ain't cool, don't let him do it, is that it touches on forced relocation again. And we see that another theme with, you know, in a little bit in, well, not so much a little bit, but in Insurrection, they touch on forced relocation again. And so that was where Picard didn't want to do it, but it was like the Starfleet and the Federation are dealing with the Cardassians and the, you know, so it was just a really heavy, weighty episode, but not just like, you know, boring. So there was a lot to it, but
right. No, and I'm all about the forced relocation elements of it, in that I'm about talking about them, not actually about forced relocation. That's not good. I don't remember how well the Native Americans were portrayed, but David, as I recall, you have a fairly good opinion of that. I just know that Star Trek has had, both in the past and then after this episode, not a great relationship with the way it portrays Native Americans.
Yeah, well, in one respect, even like bad representation is at least representation. If you go back and watch, obviously one of the very first ones is, and I'm just going to get through this quick because it's not all about this topic, but in TOS, there was the whole Paradise Syndrome with Kirok. That was like the bad stereotypes, well-intentioned, but bad stereotypes. But you look at the Star Trek, the motion picture, and when Kirk gets all the crew together to say, hey, look at this big energy cloud and the Klingon, you know, what happened, when you, over his shoulder, and then when you see in the shot, you see several Native Americans with their cultural regalia in their, you know, in their hair, their necklace, you know, stuff. And so that was like, okay, cool representation. Very, you know, minimal, or, you know, not overly addressed, but they're there, so that's a cool representation. Journey's End, I think, is probably one of the best representations of Native American culture, people, but also addressing the topic, because Picard is like, they tell Picard, like, oh, you're Picard, so you're like seven generations removed or whatever from when one of Picard's ancestors forcibly relocated, and so now they're saying you're here all this time later to make it right, you know. And so it was just a really good portrayal. They weren't caricatures. They didn't have to, like, you know, be cartoon figures or whatever. And so it was really good, real, and they actually addressed them as like actual real Native American nation tribe instead of just like later on Chakotay with some made up thing. But so Journey's right. End is one of my favorite episodes, but also one of my favorite Wesley episodes. But I think it, when it really comes down to it, it probably would be the First Duty.
Yeah, I think that when I, the thing that bothered me about Journey's End that I recall, and if I could say more accurately if I'd watched it more recently, but I recall that the whole idea of Wesley walking another's path didn't jive with me, because everything I'd seen about Wesley until this point told me that he was almost destined to be a Starfleet officer. Like he
That's kind
to
of
be...
everything they told us about his character from the beginning. They're like, oh yeah, Wesley, Lil Wesley, company man through and through, totally gonna run this shit and ship when he's
right.
older.
Like, when Jake said he didn't want to be in Starfleet, I bought it because they'd built it up for a while. But with Wesley, it was kind of odd that suddenly he didn't, like, feel like he belonged in Star Trek. And I could have bought it if we'd had more episodes in between. I think that was my biggest problem. Also, I'm just not crazy about the Traveler. Like, as a plot device, I don't much care for him. But I think you're right, David. Journey's End is still pretty good by Wesley episode standards, and it has, you know, a good discussion to be had about force relocation. So I'll give it major props for that. But back to the First Duty. The reason that I think it really works is because you get to have Wesley play off of Picard in a way that isn't just Picard being a grumpy old man towards Wesley, which is like the biggest problem that they had between those two characters. So there's like
from day one, that was the problem between the two of them.
Right. And so there is like legitimate conflict there. And I mean, and then just the way that it hits home. I mean, who among us hasn't been in a situation where we felt torn between being loyal to our friends and doing what we know is right as part of a more abstract, you know, code of behavior? Like, I'm sure that's happened to all of us on some level, even if it's a small one. So it's really easy to, you know, empathize with that and know what's going on. So I think that the First Duty, it just does a really good job with a character that most of the time they didn't know what to do with.
Well, and I think an overarching element to Wesley's character, and we can see it, you know, spots of it, especially in Journey's End, in First Duty, and with Picard, is he's basically always looking for or leaning on or seeking whatever, like a father figure or a mentor figure. And I think that's partly why he did, like, you know, aside from him having, like, you know, mental mastery of stuff like science for being a Mozart, whatever, he could have been a Federation scientist. He could have been an independent scientist. But because his father was in Starfleet and he basically lost his father so young, he was always trying to, like, capture that or regain that or learn, you know. And so then Picard becomes his father figure. And then, in a way, the Traveler was not so much a father figure, but like a mentor figure. And then in the case of First Duty, even though he's not like an old adult father, Locarno almost becomes like that figure, like somebody to follow, somebody to emulate. And then I liked it in the First Duty because we see that after it happens, Wesley is in the, you know, talking to Picard, and he tries to fall back into the mentor father figure role, and Picard snaps him out of that. And it's like, you know, addressing him as a cadet, as an officer. And I think that was just a really cool exchange. But I think that's part of Wesley's issue, is that he, you know, never had the father figure, the role model. So he was always trying to, like, so in First Duty and then even Journey's End, it's kind of like he had to be nudged or shown, but then he's like taking his own path. Like, he's being himself, not just, you know, what other people would want to make him into.
Yeah. I think that overall, that's why it works so well. Grace, do you have anything else you want to say about First Duty before we move on?
Just that I think it's where Wesley needed to go as a character in order for us to, you know, be able to round out the series without being with a better opinion of him.
Right. So my next one, which is an episode I've talked about before, but I would be remiss if I didn't include it, is The Face of the Enemy.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, in my opinion, the only good episode that focuses on Troy. And it's not, you know, my issues with Troy, as I said before, but I'll disclaim them, they're not issues with Marina Sirtis. I think Marina Sirtis is terribly underserved by the dialogue that they give Troy. and how they don't really ever let her use her powers for any use in any useful way, and she's always, you know, portrayed as not really knowing what's going on and not being a very good therapist. And when characters need real therapy, they go to Guinan or Data sometimes, but not ever to Troi. But this episode is when Troi gets kidnapped by a Romulan dissident and altered to look Romulan, placed on a Romulan ship to basically help them smuggle important members of the unification movement out of Romulus, because this is a follow-up to the episode Unification, where Spock basically is on Romulus causing trouble. And
Spock does now, apparently.
Yeah, that's what he does. He hangs out on Romulus and stirs the pot a bit. It's great.
He's a rabble rouser.
Cowboy diplomacy.
And so they kidnapped Troi. I don't know why they kidnapped Troi, honestly. They picked Troi.
She knows how to roll diplomacy, for one thing.
Well, she does in this episode. In other episodes, you can be forgiven for not thinking so. This episode, we get to see, Troi actually... They never specifically say it, but the way that Troi so quickly adapts to her situation, where she's, you know, being told to play a Romulan Tal Shiar officer... It's like, what does Troi know about the Tal Shiar? But she adapts very, very quickly, and I've assumed that's because, as an empath, she can read what other people expect of her. And, she knows how to respond to the captain because she can read the captain so well. And so she gets to hold her own with this very awesome Romulan captain, who I also really appreciate. And it's just great. It's great seeing Marina Sirtis get to strut her stuff and show us what she can actually do when the script gives her good stuff to work with.
It's good to see Marina Sirtis get to do that, and it's also good to see Troi as a character that just sort of used to their full potential to be like, yeah, this is what you can do with a super-powered empath on board. Yeah, it's like, but when the episode's over, you're left kind of wondering, well, why doesn't the Enterprise do that with her more often, you know?
Most underutilized crew member.
Yep.
I especially love the part when the Romulan guy is trying to, tell her what's going to happen, and she's like, no, you don't know what's happening anymore. You don't have a plan. We're going to do things my way now. And this part is just so great. You almost never get
to see Troi. It's really cool to see her boss. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's also, because Troi is always so reserved and so, if not passive, at least kind of timid. But she shouldn't be, right? As an empath, she should know when there's a time to be assertive. And it does, and it works here, but she doesn't always seem to know how to do that. And you just figure that she would be better in social situations than Troi often is. She's often very awkward and doesn't really know what to do,
You gotta wonder if being raised by Luxuana made her just kind of a little more reserved than she would be, otherwise.
Yeah, I could see that. I suppose that's possible. I still wish that she was more more like this in other episodes. If we had seen her more like this in other episodes, we would, we just have a better show on our hands.
Definitely. At least one with better female representation in it.
No doubt. Plus, I also just love Romulans, just straight up. This episode is
We get to see some great Romulan stuff in this, yeah.
And this episode maybe doesn't have quite as much material as the first duty did, but it's just, it is, I love watching it. Whenever I watch it again, it's I never get tired of it. Just because I love seeing Troi walk around in the Romulan costume and, deal with this, have that really, really awkward Romulan dinner where the captain is like, yeah, so by the way, I also hate the Tal Shiar and everything that you stand for. And Troi is kind of effortlessly, yeah, well, you're a lame person and I'm the best Romulan. And they have a Romulan off, and Troi wins, and it's great.
It was a cool, another element where it could be done in lots of different ways, but this was also the kind of thing where it starts off with the idea or the premise, concept, whatever, of the fish out of water. It's where you take somebody, and they're not sure of themselves, they're not sure of the situation, and then you see the process of her dealing with that, overcoming it, and then taking charge of the situation. So it's kind of cool to see that progression in her character, and it would show that she, Starfleet training, but also the person's character themselves, that they're not gonna freak out and shut down or do something inappropriate. Or it was just cool to see her because it's not, she's not in a, like, teaching a Starfleet course at the academy where it's like, it would be maybe nervous and pressure, but you're in a familiar, you know, environment, where here she's in a total enemy ship having to do this stuff, and then she just, you know, nails it.
Which is something that, you know, if she, I wish she would do more often. Now,
right, it's really cool to see a character just instantly being like, nope, nope, I'm not out of control here. I am owning this situation. And it's really cool to see a character like Troy get to do that also. It's just, this episode is really good. I always forget how much I like it.
Now, the next one is ironically also about a counselor, because that's what Ezri is. You can forget that very easily, but Ezri is in fact the station's counselor. That was her job before she became, before she got a symbiont. And I tried to find a good Ezri episode, and like my choices kind of came down to Field of Fire and then this three-parter, which is Penumbra, Till Death Do Us Part, and Strange Bedfellows. And I watched all of them, which was all like, that's like four episodes of Star Trek trying to find something. And I sort of came to the conclusion that I don't think there is a good Ezri story. Like, Field of Fire is certainly about Ezri, but it's kind of like this random thing that Ezri does where suddenly she's like a murder solver because she has like her Hannibal Lecter host who is telling her stuff, which doesn't really match with what we'd seen of him before. Because as we established at the beginning of this podcast, continuity is all that matters to me. But it just
the problem
seemed...
was,
go ahead.
The problem was, I think they just kind of, they kind of had Ezri there and weren't entirely sure what to do with her. And the problem is that with all the other characters, they had a previous six seasons worth of continuity and character interaction to work off of. But then they're like, oh, now we've got another main character and we don't have that history of interaction with other characters to work with. So it was kind of them shoehorning her into a niche there. And sometimes it worked, sometimes not so much.
Yeah, I think that you're right about that. I definitely sympathize with them having to deal with introducing a new character in Season 7. But Ezri, especially, I thought was really problematic because, especially, like, you know, in the three-parter of Penumbra, Till Death Do Us Part, and Strange Bedfellows, those are great episodes. But they show the fundamental contradiction of Ezri's character, which is that her problem is that she can't separate herself from Jadzia and her other hosts, so she goes to live the one place where everyone knows her as Jadzia, which is kind of like if your problem is that you catch on fire too much, going to live in a fire. Like, it's, you know, it doesn't really work like that.
But do you think that would, well, maybe not. I'm kind of, right as I was thinking this, I thought, well, probably not. But do you think that would be, in a way, a good place to go to help her deal with it? Because if she just went to some Trill place, they would just be like not having, not knowing her situation. Well, because obviously some people don't remember if they don't watch DS9 that she wasn't prepared and trained and honed and polished to be a host. It was kind of thrust upon her and it was an emergency situation. So she didn't get the whole Trill Academy or, you know, training and discipline of, okay, you're going to be a host. It's like, boom, now you're a host. So maybe that would be they're not going to call her Jadzia, but they all know her that you're, you know, having the Dax symbiont type thing. So maybe it definitely would be awkward, but maybe being at DS9 would be like a place where she could deal with it more because everybody there knows what happened. Whereas if she just went somewhere else, they're not going to know her situation as much.
Also a place where the Jadzia side of her could feel safe and, you know, feel like she's surrounded by people who care and feel less at odds with the Jadzia side on that note.
And maybe it's just a good for her and the symbiont together, you know, the joined union, to be near Sisko, because Sisko had a long history with that Dax symbiont, Kurzon, Jadzia, now Ezri. Maybe he would be able to, like, help her through the situation, and she could
lean
on him.
Well, as someone who isn't an expert in the psychology of joined Trill, I still feel like that doesn't seem to be what we see. It seems like it would be more important for Ezri Dax to forge her own identity. And I don't think she can do that when she's surrounded by people like Worf, who she has this really complicated history with, And we kind of see that in these three episodes, because the whole thing is basically about them needing to clear the air between them, because they have all this unresolved issues that are being brought up by them being in close quarters with each other. And it's just like, maybe, and now granted, Ezri does have a terrible family. We learned that in another episode. So I can see that she couldn't go and hang out with her family because they're just a bunch of dicks. But like, do they not have a support group for this sort of thing on Trill? Like maybe, you know, some people who wouldn't be, at the same time, wouldn't be mean to her, but also wouldn't be constantly reminding her of her previous lives? I don't know. That just seems more logical to me.
Well, but then again, she's also a Starfleet officer. If she were just a Trill civilian, or, you know, Trill science person or Federation, maybe that's different. But because she's in Starfleet, she has to be assigned somewhere. So maybe they figure, let's assign her back to the people that, you know, would have been a safety net for her.
Yeah, maybe it's cultural insensitivity on Starfleet's part. Like, yeah, I mean, it'll be like you're back home. It'll be like you're the same person, like you never left. It'll all be good. Yeah, just go. That kind of thing.
Considering how anti-reassociation the Trill government is, you figure they would have objected. Or at the very least, convinced Starfleet to give her some vacation, some, like, medical leave.
Or something, yeah. Well, don't they establish it's been, like, a couple months between the end of the previous season and the start of the new one?
I think they do say that, yeah. So maybe that,
like,
was...
Disco's been hanging out on Earth and everything.
Maybe she used up all of her leave and they were like, we gotta send you somewhere. It's a war on. We don't have time to, you know, not send you to Deep Space Nine. You gotta get over there.
They need counseling. Quick, send Ezri.
Dun-da-da! Action counselor!
And as we see, Ezri doesn't know about counseling because, you know, friggin' Vic is better at counseling than she is. And, you know, I love that episode.
Well, Vic is just better at everything, okay?
Vic's great. I do love It's Only a Paper Moon. Fantastic episode. It just bothers me that Ezri is shown as being so incompetent at counseling.
Yeah, not incompetent, just as better.
And it seemed to me weird because DS9 just lost their chief science person with Jadzia. And so it would seem like Starfleet is going to say, okay, you need another science officer. And then they send a counselor. I thought it would have been interesting if Ezri
so that they can be counseled over their lack of actual science.
So, and that would have been interesting to see how does Ezri do science different than Jadzia. Maybe she's still a science officer, but with different specialization, like different, you know, field of study and just a whole different type of scientist. And then now she has to. So that would have been interesting. But I think there are glimpses of cool, good scenes with Ezri. But in terms of like a whole episode, I think Field of Fire would probably be my favorite because she's got to deal with a problem to solve, personal issues with the host, and it was just more interesting in a way.
I'm serious about my theory, though. It's like people keep reporting and being like, we can't scan for meteoroids anymore, and she's like, tell me how that makes you feel.
I feel like Deep Space Nine lost on that trade. They were like, we traded a badass starship captain, science officer, and we got a counselor who kind of knows what she's doing.
And sometimes stands on her head when she's nervous.
Hey, I consider that a bonus, personally. You know, if your counselor can do gymnastics, you know, why not? Just add that on there. Now, in the episode, the three-parter that I was talking about, it primarily focuses on the Jadzia-Worf relationship, or at least the kind of the end of it, where they were like, we're not going to have a Jadzia Worf relationship, guys. Just deal with that. That's not happening. Here's our three-parter, an Ezri Worf relationship, I should say. And here's our three-parter where we're going to explain to you why we're not doing that.
Yeah, I was kind of glad they did that, actually.
Yeah, I mean, and it works in some cases and not in others. Like, I'll admit I had a really negative reaction when Worf kind of slut-shames her, where he's like, how many people did you sleep with? But then again, I appreciate that Ezri is like, you know, tells him to what he can do with that. And then at the end, Worf is like, okay, yeah, that was not cool. I shouldn't have said that. So, yeah, I mean, it kind of worked, but it was overall, I guess, I was much more interested in the Damar storyline, actually, that was happening at the same time. Because that's the part where Damar is learning that the Cardassians are really getting the losing end of the stick here. The Dominion doesn't care about them. And also, the Kai Wynn story is really heating up at this point. So I think maybe that the Ezri Worf story suffered from being the least interesting thing of three subplots that were running through the episode.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with you on that one.
Well, and Worf just sometimes is a dumbass. I mean, if you look at what you just said about how he was slut shaming Esri, and then go back to the Risa episode with the fun police, where Worf was like, "You're having too much fun,
Too much fun.
stop flirting, that's inappropriate." It's like Worf's just like, stick in the mud sometimes, and so he needed to loosen up. And I think that's not just, Klingon, and that's not just, that's how Starfleet. I think that's just a Worf issue, like his own personal, his backstory, his like upbringing, and what he's, stuck between the two worlds and that. So I just think Worf is
He had fun once. It was awful.
And then a little kid died or something. It's like, so yeah, Worf. I'm glad they didn't do a Esri Worf romance, and that would have been the reassociation. So the Trill cops. Trill police would have come back and said, "Hey, you can't be romantic with Worf." But
It would
yeah,
have
it
been a
was
lot of
interesting.
Trill pearl clutching and what have you.
Although this episode also started the Esri Bashir relationship, which I thought was kind of forced, but that's another discussion entirely. Our next episode that I wanted to discuss comes from Voyager, and it is the episode Rise, and it features a guy named Tuvok and another character who is, I don't know who he is exactly. He looks like Neelix, but he can't possibly be Neelix because he's not annoying or stupid or incompetent. And so I don't know who this other
All the main
character is.
traits that you associate with Neelix.
Yeah, like I don't know who this person is. Like I think he's a shapeshifter, honestly. Like I think he just replaced Neelix for an episode. Like he needed a place to hide out and was
And
like,
his
"I'll
food actually tasted good and was, healthy for you.
It's just so this Rise is an episode where Tuvok and Neelix are stranded on an alien planet when they were in the middle of like a rescue operation, and they can't get back to Voyager. Voyager can't contact them for reasons. So the only way they can get back up to Voyager is to get with a couple of other survivors of the planet onto this old space elevator. And first of all, space elevators are cool. So I love space elevators. So bonus
Yes, they
point.
are universally recognized as being just plain neat.
So bonus point for space elevator. And of course, space elevators are not really things Starfleet uses very often because they have shuttles and transporters, so why bother? But Neelix has worked on space elevators before, so he actually knows how they work because he's kind of done everything. He's like a jack of all trades. And this is probably the only episode I can think of where that actually came up in a useful way, where he was like, "Yeah, I've done a little bit of work on this technology that Starfleet would consider to be outdated, so I can be useful in this situation." Which is a great concept. That is a very solid concept for a character when your ship is lost in the Delta Quadrant. But they like never use him for it outside of this episode. And they also just and he also, his jokes are actually funny, which is just so weird for Neelix. And he can and you know and when he talks to the locals, he actually calms them down instead of infuriating them like he usually does.
Neelix actually does his job, and you can't, and that is out of character, I guess.
It really is. It's so weird, but I love Rise. Rise is a great episode. Especially, I love the story arc of the alien race that invades planets by throwing rocks at them. I always thought that was kind of I thought that was kind of cool.
Meteoroid shower.
Oh, you don't. It's in from the at the planet from space, not just like landing on the ground and then throwing rocks at the people. Okay,
Yeah, really big rocks from
it's been a
space.
while since I've seen it.
Like that's the actual like meta plot. That's what Voyager is dealing with. Well, Tuvok and Neelix are trying to get this, the space elevator up into space. And then what's even cooler about this episode is that when it's finally revealed that Neelix has kind of been exaggerating what he knows about space elevators, because it turns out he actually worked on models instead of actual space elevators, it still works. It doesn't make you go like, "Man, you're really annoying and I hate you for lying to us." It's more like, that's actually it's impressive that you have been able to do all this even though your experience is limited. And like it actually made the character stronger, whereas when they usually tell us more about Neelix, it just makes us go like, "Why? Why are you even here, Neelix?" And his
Well,
connection. Sorry, go ahead.
and working on the models at least shows that he had the theory and the concept of it, and that kind of reminded me back when I think it was All Good Things, but when Picard was telling O'Brien, like, "Remember all those starship model engines you used to work on? I know you could be an engineer." And so that, and then also Archer with the little model starship engine thing. And so I think that's valid, you know, to say I've never done the actual thing, but I've worked on the models, and so it's like I kind of know what I'm doing and the concept.
So he knows the theory, yeah.
Yeah, so it's, you know, it worked, and he has actual chemistry with Tuvok, which is, you know, usually he's just annoying Tuvok and calling him Mr. Vulcan and things like that, which is just kind of obnoxious. But it actually, you know, again, they work together here very well, and it was a really nice breath of fresh air. And if Neelix had been like this all the time, I would probably be much more favorable towards Voyager than I am. And the other Voyager episode that I had in mind is called Timeless, and this is the episode where Voyager gets frozen in ice because they try to use the slipstream drive and it does not work. And so then like 10 or 15 years later, Kim and Chakotay show up and they are trying to change history. And to do that, they need the Doctor's help and they need to get a little thing out of Seven's brain. And so this is the episode, you know, the one episode really where Kim gets to be cool and Chakotay also is fairly cool and doesn't, you know, it isn't really bland and boring.
Not the character combination that you would think would make for cool, also.
No, not really. Like, a couple of things that I've read or watched behind the scenes kind of indicate that Garrett Wong was just never really given any major material, and so, like, then he got this episode, which is kind of about him, and the other actors were like, oh, you actually can act. You know, now that we give you something to do, you can actually do something with it.
Well, one issue that Garrett has said in a couple interviews we've done is that he, you know, the whole like phrase or the concept of like once more with feeling, they would always tell him once more with less feeling. And so he wanted to be funny at times. He wanted to be more, you know, emotive of, you know, emotion and everything. And they would
Why would you encourage someone to be acting more blandly?
That was his frustration that, you know, all the funny lines would either go to Paris or the Doctor. The dramatic, you know, tense moments would go to like Chakotay or Tuvok or whatever. Like he would try to do a take and they would say, do it, but like dial it down. And so it was frustrating for him at times. And so in this episode, it seems like he would have his time to shine, like, you know, go for it. And he was able to do more of the acting that he would want to do.
Yeah. And much like in the first duty, he actually gets to have a conflict where he feels all this guilt because of a mistake he made that caused Voyager to crash into the ice and basically everyone on board to die. And so he has, like, there's something to him, right? Because that's part of, like, it was like when they were doing Kim, they just didn't know what he was about, which is why they keep throwing him into these bizarre
situations.
He
was about just being around there to make Tom Paris look cool.
Yeah, basically. Like, you'll notice most of the other episodes about Kim are, like, just him doing this weird stuff, like the episode where he dies and goes to, like,
which
the alien.
Which one?
All of them. But, you know, the one where he goes to the alien afterlife, or the one where the aliens try to convince him that he's actually a member of their species, and that they're, like, you know, the all-lady aliens. And, like, they almost buy it, which is my favorite part about that episode, is that when they're like, yes, your ensign is totally one of our people who just happened to be on your ship when he was thrown across the galaxy to meet us. And they're like, yeah, that sounds reasonable.
Reasonable for Voyager.
And then there was those scenes where he was just awkward with Seven, which was, like, you know, not a great way to be portrayed.
Better, the more quickly we forget those scenes, the better.
What scenes?
Oh, yes.
Good plan. Kim also gets some really great back and forth with the Doctor, where, you know, because the Doctor is great to play off of, right? Because Ricardo Montalban? What? No, that
Robert
is not the
Picardo.
Doctor.
Robert Picardo. Can you imagine Ricardo Montalban as the Doctor? That would be amazing.
Okay, wait, hang on, I got this. Please state the nature of the medical emergency.
Yay!
Okay, that's now that we've gotten the best Robert. No, wait, hang on. The best Ricardo Montalban impression out of the way. Oh my god.
Today, folks, we've learned that Oren cannot tell the difference between Robert Picardo and Ricardo Montalban.
Are they not the same people? No. Okay. So, Robert Picardo just is a great foil for, like, anybody because he's got that perfect blend of sarcasm and insight and wit going on. So any character talking to him is strengthened by the interaction. So Garrett Wong gets to play off him, and it works so great. When Wong is, or not, well, I guess it's Kim really. When Kim is like, he's plagued by guilt, but also with this like really, this intense determination. And it just works. And of course, at the same time, Chakotay is getting to go kind of toe to toe with Geordi, which is nice. And Chakotay kind of, is there
It's
and
cool to
has.
see also.
Yeah.
It's just kind of like, oh, hey, Geordi, how you doing?
It's like Geordi's here. He was directing the episode, so I guess he gets to be in it.
He's got eyes now.
Yep, they fixed that. They don't really need. He
Yep,
doesn't
yep.
need the visor no more.
Nope.
And also, Chakotay has like an actual romance relationship, which even though it's only on screen for about 15 minutes, is way better than his relationship with Seven, because that sort of, that made sense. So it's just overall Timeless is just a great episode that is about the two of the worst characters on the show, not counting Neelix. And it was not, a combination that you would expect to make a good episode.
Definitely not the expected combination. And like the Neelix episode we were talking about, this is an interesting episode in the fact that we kind of get a brief look at these characters, and you're like, oh, is this what the writers were intending with the characters from the beginning? Is this how they wanted us to see the characters, but kind of failed at? That's what I find interesting about both these episodes.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure what happened with Rise exactly, but with Timeless, it seems pretty obvious that they were like, well, this is a what-if scenario, so we can kind of do whatever we
What
want.
if they were actually cool? Yeah.
Right, there are a number of Star Trek what-if scenarios where they're able to kind of free themselves from the shackles of whatever constraints they were working under before. They do the same thing in Year of Hell in Voyager, where it's like, none of this is all going to get undone at the end of the episode, so we can kind of just do what we want. We can actually have Voyager get messed up and damaged and, stay that way. So, I think that that is a case. At least with Timeless, they probably felt like they didn't have to have Kim locked into his really, stand up Starfleet cadet. He's not a cadet, but he acts like one. His whatever his persona is that he's got going. And they also felt like they didn't have to have Chakotay be like every time, every second word out of his mouth reminding us that he's Native American. We don't know what tribe of Native American exactly, but he didn't have to be a walking stereotype anymore, basically.
Well, it was a false one created out of, they pulled it out of their something, the rubber tree people. It's like, what? That's not a thing.
They probably especially don't use a lot of dream catchers because they were supposed to be from like South or Central America. But anyway, so do you guys have anything else you want to say about those two before we go on to our last one in our last few minutes here?
Just that Timeless is a cool episode.
Right. So the last one for me is Stigma, which is from season two of Enterprise and is surprisingly good for a season two Enterprise episode. And the plot is that T'Pol has a disease that she caught from the guy who forcibly mind melded with her a few episodes earlier in Fusion, and she's been keeping it quiet. And Phlox has been trying to help her, but he can't anymore. And the conflict comes from the fact that this disease is primarily, suffered by people who conduct mind melds, and the Vulcan, establishment considers them to be an undesirable population. And so they haven't
Can you
really put
see the analogy here?
yeah, just a little bit. So they haven't put, not only have they not put much effort into finding a cure, but they actively suppress information that might help other people try to find a cure. And this,
Analogy.
yeah, and the analogy is actually very effective here to the AIDS epidemic and how there were a lot of people, especially in the early years, who were like, this only affects gay people, right? So why do we have to cure it? And that was a awful, awful thing, and it still kind of chills me that that ever happened, and to a certain extent still does. So, and I love it when Star Trek takes on those issues. Like, I think that's Star Trek at its best. And Enterprise far too often was busy, doing like weird episodes that went nowhere, like Terra Nova or other, kind of mindless things where they would go and do some kind of exploring, but not really exploring anything we cared about. But this was one episode where we're finally
I've
like, all
said
right,
before
we.
that part of what I like about Star Trek and what I like about science fiction in general is its potential to draw analogy to real world problems and sort of cast them in a different light. And this episode really it really does that, and it's really cool to see that happen. And it's, if you had told me when I started watching Enterprise that I would have gotten an episode like that with T'Pol, I probably would not have believed you, honestly.
No, I can totally see why. And my favorite thing about this episode is the way that T'Pol refuses to tell the authorities that she was coerced, but like this was, you know, that she was forced to have this mind meld, because she, you know, and it is so cool to see her be like, no, it doesn't matter that the one guy forced a mind meld on me, that, you know, that is not a judgment on other people, on other Vulcans who perform mind melds, and I'm not going to perpetuate their double standard. I'm not going to say that it's okay to treat me because I didn't choose to have this mind meld, but it's not okay to treat other people who did choose to have the mind meld. And it is such a stand on principles, which is not something I would have expected T'Pol to do, because she doesn't seem like that kind of character until now.
Yeah, she mostly just stands on things that annoy her.
That is a thing that she does a lot.
Yep.
And so, you know, and we actually got some very good acting from Jolene Blalock, who I don't know if she's a good actress or not. I've never seen her in anything else, but I know that most
she's
of the time...
She's mostly a model, isn't she?
That's what I've heard.
She's done a few, I think after Voyager, she's done a few like motion picture feature films, so she's done some other acting and been in some movies.
Yeah, so but I know that most of the time in Enterprise she's not given very much to do, but in this episode she really did. She had something good to do, and you know, it was a great parallel that was very emotional to watch. You know, and is, I thought, was very good of Star Trek to call attention to that issue, which is something, it's a unfortunate, I would say shameful part of our country's history that we're still dealing with. So, you know, good on them for having the guts to do that.
Indeed.
Now, even though I've just said all those really, really great things, the one thing that bothers me about this episode is that I kind of wish they had found a way to do it with a race other than Vulcans. Because it to me,
yeah, it kind of feels like going for the low-hanging fruit if you do it just with Vulcans, doesn't it?
Well, it was more that I thought it continued Enterprise's shtick of having the Vulcans just be huge assholes at, like, all times.
That too, yeah. Also, Enterprise was one of those series where we just, culturally, we had some kind of, we had limited interaction with other species.
Yeah.
Compared to other series.
So the part where the Vulcans are being like clearly illogical by refusing to help treat this disease, it doesn't really surprise me. It should surprise me. It should be like, hey, wait, I don't. That doesn't
but
sound
on
like
Enterprise,
something.
It doesn't surprise you.
Yeah, on Enterprise, that sounds like exactly what the Vulcans would do, because the Vulcans are just huge dicks in Enterprise, and you know,
dicks.
You know, and it's not that I can't imagine a situation in which logical people would still discriminate. Like, I can see that happening, but I think that they needed to understand Vulcans a little bit better. But that said, I'm willing to put that objection aside because of how good the rest of the episode is. And like,
right.
And also, like, Phlox. You know, Phlox doesn't get a lot of great moments either, and I really appreciate that he was a very good character in this episode. He had, you know, the way that he stands up for T'Pol is admirable.
Well, it's something that he kind of would do, wouldn't he? I mean, they're both the aliens on the ship, so they've got that kind of outsider status that they share together. Also, Phlox just seems generally like a good guy. Like, that would be his thing.
I have to admit, I also found the subplot of Phlox's wife trying to seduce Trip to be amusing. I did enjoy that. You know, it's maybe not the most mature subject ever, but I thought it was funny.
Yeah, it's one of those things that it's like, well, if you're going to talk about a guy with multiple wives, bring that in. Yeah, do it.
All right, so you guys, either of you have any final thoughts on our subject for today before we wrap up?
Only that there are a lot more characters. Like, we were talking earlier about Face of the Enemy and how we got to see an underutilized actor given a really good episode where both they as an actor and their character got to shine. There are a lot more characters that I really wished we'd gotten to see stuff like that with. I wish we'd kind of had a Crusher episode like that, you know? I really do.
Yeah, I can see that. I can definitely agree with that. David, what about you?
Well, there's other examples we could pull. And then one of the things I thought was early on, I thought Bashir was kind of a bad character or just badly written sometimes. Other times it was badly executed, but it was like season one or two. And then, of course, over the course of the whole series, we get to see Bashir go through a lot of, you know, arc and growth and change and get better. But I thought early on he was kind of my least favorite. I didn't dislike him. He was just like my least favorite of the characters.
He just wasn't very likable at the beginning, yeah.
And then once they established or introduced his relationship with Garrick, then I thought those were good episodes, like a good use of Garrick, I mean of Bashir. So that those were kind of like episodes where I thought good episodes for a not so great character. But then, you know, that developed and went on. But yeah, I wish, especially because we had ensemble cast and in a way more TNG and in cases Voyager, because they went back to a similar model. They have an ensemble cast, but they mainly focus on the captain and like the first officer. Like they almost tried to recapture the trio trinity of Kirk, Spock, McCoy, and just focus on them. So we didn't really get to see, we maybe got one or maybe two episodes that focused on the other crew, whereas in DS9 you get a little bit more of that, or they're just brought in more, you know, when they're still dealing with Sisko or whatever. So it's just, I would have liked to see each week, you know, focus on the captain and the dilemma of the ship or whatever, but then like Lower Decks, that episode is kind of like a, stands out as a one-off because they're focusing on the crew, not, you know, the lower ranks. They should have done more of that, and they should have done more of, you know, give each person their one episode or at least one to shine, but we rarely ever got that. So it was just like, you know, missed opportunities. And then when they do give Troy the Romulan episode, it stands out like, ooh, look what they're doing. This is rare and cool. So they just should have done more of it.
Yeah, I am totally for more shows being more like Deep Space Nine.
Who'd have thought?
Thank you to both of you for discussing this topic with me. We will be back next week with, if everything goes according to plan, a very interesting interview. And I will leave it at that, and you can try to figure out what exactly I mean.
Ooh.
Until then, this will be All Things Trek signing off. David, would you go ahead and give us some music?
Yep, here we go.